This week, I had an amazing conversation with Molly Dalva, a licensed professional counselor who also happens to be one of my closest friends. In this episode, we talk about all things trauma, the difference between traumatic stress and PTSD, what the different responses to trauma can look like and how they might be triggered, and how all of these things can relate to our experiences with infertility, loss, and life after infertility and loss. Molly had so many amazing things to say about trauma responses and the healing process after experiencing trauma. She also shared so many practical tips and next steps someone who has experienced trauma can take, as well as ways others can support and validate someone they love who has experienced trauma. I especially loved when Molly said, "Our brain and our body are always trying to protect us. Any experience or response someone has to trauma is valid." I'm excited for you to be able to listen in on what is truly a regular conversation topic whenever Molly and I are together. Thank you for being here, friend. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Catalyst for Courage podcast. Each week, we'll be sharing practical tips, inspiring stories, and a whole lot of courage and hope for those of us in the trenches of infertility and pregnancy loss. I'm your host, Lindsay Blair. I'm a certified bereavement doula, trauma specialist, and fertility coach with a passion to support others with stories like mine. Together, we can make the shift from barely surviving to truly thriving, even in the midst of infertility and loss. You are not alone, friend. Let's dive in and ignite hope together. Hey, Molly, welcome to the Catalyst for Courage podcast. You're the first person that I've ever had in the studio.
Pretty sweet.
We've been friends for how many years? How long has it been?
I don't know.
Gosh, I feel like it's been like 2014, 2015, something like that.
Yeah, math is hard.
Math is really hard.
Yeah.
It's funny, for those of you listening, Molly and I actually went to Clemson together. We were there at the same time. Never met while we were in school there, but our paths crossed a little bit later when I was working in the nonprofit world for an anti-trafficking organization. Molly signed on to volunteer, and I feel like the rest is history.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always so wild that we were there at the same time in school and had no interaction.
But it's funny, it was through working at the nonprofit that really opened my eyes in a lot of ways to the realities of trauma, specifically through the lens of sexual trauma with trafficking survivors. And I think you were in grad school, right, at the time.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we both kind of started learning a lot about this together.
A lot of conversations.
So many conversations, which is fun that we're having it now, because I feel like these conversations are kind of a staple in our friendship.
We do this a lot. Not in this way, but we do this a lot.
But I'm excited because I feel like a lot of the things that we talk about are things that I wish other people knew, specifically about trauma, and especially how it relates to infertility and pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
And it was through some of those conversations with you that I was going through my own journey of infertility and recurrent pregnancy loss. And I think that's when I really started connecting some of the dots that experience for me was traumatic.
Yeah.
And that I was having some side effects and some symptoms of trauma as a result.
Well, it was definitely a piece for me too, that it wasn't something at that point in my understanding of trauma that I had considered infertility as a piece of that. And so I think as we've grown individually together, there's just been a greater understanding for us both of what trauma actually is and how it shows up.
There's so much that I really want to talk to you about, and I just am excited for others to be able to listen in on. But before we get too deep into it, because I know we will, and I know that that's coming. But before we do, I would love for you to share just a little bit about yourself and what led you to this field, maybe some of what you do, just for people listening to know a little bit more about you.
So I will start with the fact that I am a dog mama to my precious baby, Rainy. She's my Rainy bug, and Lindsay knows this about me, but she is my whole world. She's been along for the ride in my own healing journey, and that is a big part of why I am in this work. I have found therapy to be an incredibly healing experience. And I've had good experiences in therapy, and I've had other experiences that maybe weren't as positive and felt a lot of passion towards working specifically with trauma and wanting to create a different type of therapy space that really had the safety that is necessary to heal trauma. But I started off teaching special education and loved it, loved teaching. but really saw families that were impacted by something much greater.
And you're so good at it too. I know I can't speak from personal experience because you've never been my therapist, but yes, working alongside you and watching the way that you interact and the way that you've been able to serve people that I know and love dearly through the work that I did in the nonprofit world, I know that you're fantastic at what you do. And I'm just really excited for people to get to know more about you and about your work and really about trauma. Mm-hmm. So let's start there. What what is trauma? Because I think I know people think of it as like people who have gone to war, and you think of, you know, terrible natural disaster, a car accident, and then even more recently, sexual trauma is being talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. But what is it? What is trauma? How do you even define it?
Yeah, I think how you're articulating it already is we think about it in the context of our world in terms of an event. Mm-hmm. And really, at its core, it's much less about the event, but more about how it has impacted us. And that's something we're shifting in the psychotherapy world, even to understand more that it's about a response in our nervous system. And so we can't look at any one event and say someone has experienced trauma from this, but we look at their symptoms, their response to an experience, and that is what tells us that they've experienced trauma.
I think that so many of us probably get caught up in the nitty gritty and in the defining events, but sometimes we don't think about the other ways that someone could experience trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think that that can lead to a lot of minimization of experiences for people, where if it's not one of those really big events that is talked about, that there's this, oh my gosh, but why do I feel this way?
And so, feel like something's wrong with you.
Right. Exactly. And that becomes one of the hallmarks that I see all the time is, but this didn't happen to me, or this did happen to me, but this other thing that's actually bothering me more wasn't as bad. It wasn't as big of a deal. And so I don't understand why I'm having this response to this thing.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that as we get even deeper into this conversation, we can hopefully some people listening can feel a little more validated in their experience. That if you do, when Molly shares more about symptoms of trauma and what that could look like, if that's something that you identify with, hopefully you can feel a little more seen and supported and validated in your experience, because I know that was the case for me. I didn't think that what I had been through was trauma, you know, because there's other people that I was working with and supporting who had been through what to me was defined as real trauma.
Right.
And infertility and pregnancy loss wasn't something that was ever talked about in regards to trauma. So I think that a lot of us in this community have probably dismissed our own feelings of trauma and our own experiences.
Yeah. So if we think about trauma as a response, it really is this imprint that we have on our mind, our body, our spirit, that alive in the present is how it shows up. And so the imprint of trauma can come alive in us in different ways, depending on the type of trauma. Maybe if it was one time or it happened many times, maybe we've experienced several different types of trauma. And it depends on our access to support at the time the trauma happened, our genetics, emotional, physical state. All of that impacts the impact of trauma. This is why we can't define it on the event. We could all respond to the same event differently. Mm-hmm. One could develop symptoms of traumatic stress and the other might not.
Okay. So when you say traumatic stress, I think a lot of times people hear traumatic stress and they hear trauma and they automatically assume PTSD. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, what does traumatic stress automatically mean, post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah.
Or is that something different? How are they related and how do they differ?
Mm-hmm. So PTSD is what we use and we reference in terms of clinical diagnosis. And so there's this big old book that we have to study as therapists called the DSM-5. It has many editions, more will be to come, but it defines the criteria of someone meeting diagnosis. A diagnosis is something we use for insurance so that people can get coverage for services. It also has the potential to be very validating for people to see, oh, wow, these symptoms, it's a thing. This exists. What I'm experiencing is real. But where we get into trouble is when we say that it's only real if there's a diagnosis. But at the end of the day, it really is this clinical criteria, and it is very structured and therefore very limiting. And so a lot of times it can exclude experiences of trauma that are equally as impacting, but are really only excluded based on one or two criteria.
What does that tend to look like?
Yeah, so that's, and you'll hear as we flesh this out a little bit, that the diagnosis, although very limiting, also is very subjective in some ways. It is objective and also subjective, because we could look at that and say, like, what is limiting to the functioning of life? For a lot of us, if we have the experience of, man, one of the experiences I have from having trauma, having experienced trauma, is that I have insomnia. I don't sleep, or I have very restless sleep, or maybe I have nightmares. And when we have that happen ongoing, it can impact the way that we function at our job, mm-hmm. right? To get up and go to work is so much harder for us at that point. But we might show up to work in a way that maybe on paper, our job functioning looks the same. Maybe our coworkers wouldn't necessarily know that that's a part of the story. But for us internally, the impact is really significant.
I think that's really interesting too, because I think a lot of times when people think about PTSD and what it looks like, we assume it's the war veteran that hits the deck in the grocery store because somebody knocked over a can, which seems very obvious, which those cases absolutely do and, you know, are valid and do exist. But from what I hear you saying, it could be that someone has PTSD and other people around them would never have any way of knowing that. Mm-hmm. And it would really depend on that person having a level of self-awareness and honesty.
And it's a degree to which the symptoms are present. And so we might have some symptoms that we've learned to deal with. Maybe we've had PTSD for a long time. And so a lot of the symptoms actually feel pretty normal, pretty manageable. And so we may not disclose them in a way that says, yeah, this impacts my life. Because we've had to develop ways of dealing with those symptoms that they actually no longer on the surface really impact our lives. And so I think that depends on what we have had access to, if we're going to develop worse symptoms, or if we go that route of, I now have to develop strategies in order to cope with these symptoms. And this is just how life is now. This is just how things go.
What could someone listening who thinks that they may have traumatic stress, how would you encourage them, or what would you say if they're wondering if this is not normal? I hate the word normal, because I feel like trauma is not normal. Like, these are our body's normal reactions to abnormal circumstances and events that we've experienced. So I say normal loosely, but what's the difference? Is that important even to distinguish if your traumatic stress is post-traumatic stress disorder?
If it has impacted you, you are deserving of support. No more than that, no less than that. Diagnosis, no diagnosis, doesn't matter. If it has impacted you, whether that's just internally, you are not showing the world the depth of that impact, or whether it is externally, whether it feels like, man, I am dropping balls and life is really hard. This is really significant. Either way, you are still deserving of support.
That's good. If you hear nothing else, honestly, I think that to me, that's a takeaway.
Yeah, I think that pulls into, you know, we've talked a lot about, like, how do you redefine trauma? When we talk about redefining it, one of my favorite definitions I've heard is anything that is too much, too soon, too much for too long, or too little for too long. And so as you can hear in that, man, what's too much too soon for me could be really different from somebody else. And so it really looks at the impact of that.
I think that's really impactful, just that whole breakdown of too much too soon, too much for too long, or too little for too long. I would love to kind of dive in a little deeper to each one of those, maybe with some practical examples. Obviously, we're not going to be able to exhaust every option for what this could look like, but starting with when something is too much too soon, what could that look like? And what does that look like for some people? What does that mean?
Yeah, so too much too soon is a lot of the big events that we think of when it comes to trauma. That's can be that event-based thinking, but really it's the events that are going to have an impact on us. How much it impacts us is different for everybody, but usually it's too much too soon. So a car accident that we weren't expecting, too much too soon. A sexual assault, too much too soon. This can also include, when we say too soon, we think about age. So things that may have happened when we were young and we weren't ready. Our brains weren't developed to be able to navigate the situations we faced.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm even thinking about just how this relates to fertility and pregnancy loss, that too much too soon could be receiving like a huge diagnosis that, you know, maybe you just got married or you're in your early 20s and all of a sudden you're finding out that your chances of conceiving are 1% or, you know, something just really astronomical, and that it feels, you know, like your whole life plan has been thwarted, or maybe it's a procedure that went like really, really differently than what you were anticipating it to be. Or I'm thinking too, with the loss of a pregnancy or a baby. So I think all of those experiences, if you've experienced anything like that, that to me is an example of what it could look like in our reproductive stories of something being too much too soon.
Yeah.
What about too much for too long?
Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily mean that any one event was like, whoa, astronomical impact from this. But every event that happened was just a little bit too much. Mm. And those events happened over and over and over and over and over. You know, I think about that with our experience with working with trafficking and sexual exploitation. You know, that's that combination where we see too much too soon with too much for too long. And we start to have that cumulative build on top where it expands and how much it impacts us, because it's both.
And with fertility and reproductive stories, I feel like even if you've been trying to conceive for months and years and you've tried different treatments and you've seen doctors and every month of getting your hopes up and trying for something, and even just seeing a negative pregnancy test over and over and over and over again for years at a time, doing medicated cycles, IUIs, IVF, and whether or not you've done IVF or IUI is, I don't think, is relevant. Again, this is individualized experiences. So I think that could be a very real and a very valid example of too much for too long.
Yeah. And I feel this, like I want to be really clear about what too much is, and that is such a personal thing. And it's really anything that overwhelms our ability to cope with the resources that we have at the moment. And so when we think about it that way, something that might not ordinarily be too much, depending on the amount of support, access to resources, medical care, whatever that might look like, if that is lacking, it becomes too much in that moment. And so if we don't have the resources to cope with it right then, it impacts us on a nervous system level. There's an impact, an imprint that we talk about.
I think that's really helpful. And I don't know, I just think that thinking about trauma in this way is probably really different than a lot of us are used to. But also, I feel like it can feel really validating and freeing that no one can define your experience but you. The last one that you had mentioned was too little for too long.
Yeah.
Which sounds a little opposite from the last one.
This is the one we think the least about. And so when I think about this, I think about, you know, maybe as a kid, you grew up in a home that didn't talk about feelings. And so you didn't get that access to, what do I do when I get angry? Is it okay for me to be angry? And so we don't get the emotional development that we need. And that really can leave an impact on us as we grow as adults. And so we didn't have enough support for too long, too little for too long. I'm really curious about that one as far as infertility goes. Maybe an example that you have.
I think a big example is a lot of people don't talk about infertility or miscarriage. You know, in our culture, we live in a culture where you don't announce a pregnancy until you are through the first trimester, which is 13 weeks of pregnancy. And infertility is something that people don't really talk about. I think it's why a lot of people listening have probably had people ask them, oh, when are you going to have kids? And there's a lot of pressure to say, mm-hmm. oh, maybe one day, or, mm-hmm. you know, maybe if you're feeling really honest, you might even say we're working on it.
Right.
Or you might, if you're feeling really honest, go to that deeper level and say, you know, actually we're going through fertility challenges. We've been seeing a specialist and we've been trying for months or years and it hasn't worked. And so I think that just that culture that we have sets a precedent for there to be too little support for too long. That especially when it comes to the emotional and the mental support side of it, you know, our fertility doctors are wonderful at what they do medically, but I think that's not their realm to be able to provide that emotional support. I think it's such a not understood thing, even for a lot of mental health providers.
Sure.
We're lucky in our area. There are some that specialize in that. And I think people who are well-versed in trauma have more of an understanding for this. But for something that affects 1 in 4 and 1 in 8 people in our country, mm-hmm. it's something that's not really discussed a whole lot. And people are going through it mm-hmm. in silence and maybe with the support of some close friends or family members, or maybe even a trusted, like a coach or a therapist. But there are other people too that maybe their partner doesn't even really understand what they're going through, and their friends don't really understand, and their family doesn't really understand or care to. Maybe they grew up in a household, like you mentioned, that feelings weren't really talked about.
Right.
And that experience of not being able to easily conceive is kind of brushed under the rug. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of also, I could go on a whole tangent about this, I won't, but toxic positivity in our culture, where people may feel vulnerable enough and safe enough to share that they're going through fertility challenges and this hasn't been easy as they thought it would be or hoped mm-hmm. it would be. And they're met with, oh, well, just relax. Mm-hmm. It'll happen in God's time. When you least expect it, it'll happen. Just do this, just do that. And so the very nature of those types of responses is really dismissive. Mm-hmm. And that isn't offering support. It's not validating what the person is going through. And it can feel really, really lonely. And so I imagine hearing that a lot from loved ones, family members, friends, colleagues, that could be a big example of too little for too long.
And that's the one that gets hidden the most, because when we've had too little for too long, we learn that we can't receive what we need from people. Mm-hmm. And so we develop all of these strategies that say, hey, just say this instead, because mm-hmm. if you give this answer, they're not going to ask more questions.
Mm-hmm.
We become really self-protective because we have the expectation that we hold then of it's already been too little for too long. I can't even expect that I have the potential to get what I need. And so we just start expecting that we won't.
So I know you mentioned earlier just the difference of single incident trauma, mm-hmm. that example of too much too soon, mm-hmm. versus some of the more cumulative examples mm-hmm. of trauma in the case of the too much for too long or too little for too long.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to talk a little bit more about that piece, just that cumulative piece, because I feel like a lot of us who specifically are going through infertility, mm-hmm. that a lot of their experience with that, if they do have symptoms of trauma and traumatic stress, there might not be this one traumatic thing, but more of accumulation of experiences and lack of support. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to symptoms of traumatic stress or PTSD, mm-hmm. what might that look like for someone who has been through infertility and hasn't had like this one thing that caused trauma, but it's been more of those later examples that we talked about of cumulative events and experiences?
So I think when I consider that in the context of infertility, like you've talked about, a lot of people have that one moment that is too much too soon. And because of the nature of the process of infertility, it's an ongoing. Mm-hmm. There are more doctor's appointments to come.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to have to face this procedure potentially in our future. And with that on the table, our systems go, oh my gosh, like this is a lot. This is a lot. And in the context of cumulative or even anticipating cumulative experiences, we start to see less of the acute symptoms and we start to see more of what I would consider to be strategies. Mm-hmm. So our system, instead of saying, oh my gosh, this is a lot, this is a lot, this is a lot, we say, okay, this is going to be a lot. So I need a way to be able to manage the allotness of this. And so we might start to internalize our experiences. We might start to sit through doctor's appointments and nod and smile as if all is well. Everything that doctor is saying, yes, absolutely. But it's like the most beautiful and brilliant response that we could have. But someone's not going to look at that and say, oh yeah, that person has traumatic stress happening for them, right? You're going to come across as pretty well managed.
I feel like I'm just thinking too about that pressure to be okay.
Oh yeah.
Because I'll just speak from my experience. I know sometimes, you know, when I was going through recurrent pregnancy loss and infertility, there was almost this pressure that I put on myself to, when I would go to see my doctor, that I had to look like I was okay. Because in my mind, if he saw or thought that maybe I wasn't okay, that he may would delay a treatment or recommend me to take a break. And that felt threatening. Yeah. Just that, even that pressure that I was putting on myself. My doctor was amazing. He never put any kind of pressure like that on me. But it was almost this just grasping at control and feeling like, if I show any signs that I am not okay right now, and that this has been too much too soon, or too much for too long, or too little for too long, that I may be faced with more disappointment and more delays and more unmet hopes and expectations. And to me, that felt even scarier and worse than just admitting that I really wasn't okay.
Yeah, it becomes, if I show the realness of this pain to myself or to others, that I actually am at greater risk of threat. And so that's where we start building those skills, those strategies that say, I'm not going to show that internally I'm panicking. I'm going to show up in a way that says, I'm here, I'm capable, and I can get what I need.
And I think too, our culture, I mentioned it earlier, but just the pressure that we put on ourselves and on women who are going through fertility challenges or pregnancy loss. Like, we don't have mandated leave for, you know, bereavement leave for pregnancy loss. I think some companies are starting to offer it, but I know that there are people who are going through these things and also feel the pressure, not only from maybe their medical team, but to present and be fully okay at work and with their friends and with their family members. To the point where, like, we just don't really give ourselves permission to not be okay. And that feels easier in some ways, and it feels safer.
There's a lot at stake in our culture to admit that we're not okay.
Yeah. What are some ways, going back, I know we've talked a lot about relating trauma to fertility experiences, and I think that's important. But even just backing up a little bit, like, what are some ways, because I feel like trauma is trauma. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've talked about this a lot, that it doesn't really matter what it was, the event, like you said, that caused the trauma. Trauma is trauma, and some of the ways that we experience it and the way that symptoms present. But what are some typical ways that we may respond or present after experiencing trauma?
Yeah. So I love that you're bringing up trauma responses, and I'm just going to take a minute and kind of talk about that piece that we're about to get into. But this is the moment that our system recognizes that we're experiencing something beyond our ability to cope. And I used the word strategy before, but strategy is also a way to say trauma response. And then we have to develop a way to survive. This usually happens subconsciously in our system, and it's outside of our awareness. And it's coming from a place where our body is saying, survival is our top priority. So what do we need to do right now to get through this?
I feel like the ones that I tend to think of are fight, flight, or freeze.
Yeah.
So is that kind of what you're talking about with the strategies and the trauma responses?
Yeah. So in that moment where your body says, oh my gosh, we just have to get through this, how are we going to do it? Right. So it resorts to what is built into our system biologically, which are these typical responses that we think of. We're going to run away from it if we can. If we can't run, we're going to fight it off. But at that point, we get into the nitty gritty of what happens if we can't fight it off. What happens if it's an ongoing thing? So we think about infertility. We want to have a baby. Mm-hmm. We're going to go through whatever it takes to get to that point.
Yep.
And so it is a choice that we are going through these steps. It is not a choice that we are experiencing trauma from it.
I love that. I love what you said too, that it's a choice that we are going through these steps because there's something that we want at the end. Mm-hmm. We are doing everything we can to have a baby, knowing that this is really hard. These treatments, the tests, the doctor's appointments, the heartbreak every month of seeing a negative pregnancy test is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. But then I also love what you said, that it's not our choice to experience trauma as a result.
So if we go back to thinking about the different types of trauma responses, we hear fight, flight, freeze. Those are the three that we hear the most often. Mm-hmm. And so fight or flight is the very active response. And if our body is able to, we will do that first. If our body has tried those and realizes this isn't going to work, we can't get away, we can't fight this off. Or if we've tried to fight or flee from this before and it hasn't worked, we make the automatic assumption. Or if it feels too big, just too big, too much, we might go into what we call the freeze response. And that is where inside we have all of this energy and activation that says, man, I really want to run. I really want to get out of here. I really want to fight this off. But we're frozen.
So when I think about someone who's going through any kind of reproductive challenges, so I know we've talked a little bit about infertility, but I also want to really acknowledge the reality of pregnancy loss and people who may have conceived and have experienced trauma as a result of loss or multiple losses. Just thinking about these trauma responses, the fight, flight, or freeze, just kind of breaking some of that down for people listening who may even, what kind of things come to your mind?
Yeah, so this would be like reactivity. We are advocating in such a way, potentially, when we talk about infertility specifically. We are advocating, but if we are activated, if we are in a trauma response state by something, we're going to seem maybe a little bit reactive, maybe a little bit aggressive in that sense of advocacy.
I can certainly relate to some of that. Mm-hmm. And even just when people would even lovingly suggest, like, taking a break, like that, to me, activated a huge, like a fight response. You know, it felt threatening. So I think that's
like defensiveness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about flight?
Yeah. So when we get into flight, we've got internal and we've got external. And so if we are fleeing from our own internal emotions, right, we would really internalize everything that's happening. And we would throw ourselves into whatever we can do to distract. So can I take on more things at work right now? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Can I commit to another church thing that I have on the table for Wednesday nights when I really don't have any other free nights? Yeah, I can. And so I'm pulling this energy away from the emotional distress that's inside of me, and I'm exerting it elsewhere as an intention to move away from the discomfort and distress of that. And then if we think about external, I mean, we could see this. I'm thinking about doctor's appointments that maybe we don't get a response that feels helpful or supportive, and something in our system says, ooh, danger, not safe, whether that's physically or emotionally. We might physically get up and run out of that room. We might leave. So that's the most common one that we think of with that response, but it can be both.
And I think just, again, we live in a world where there's so much noise, and it's hard to sit in silence and really acknowledge what it is that we're feeling.
Yeah.
What about freeze?
Yeah. So freeze, I think one of the more common ones that we would see would be like procrastination. So if you need to schedule an appointment, but you anticipate that it's going to be really overwhelming for your system, as much as you know you need to schedule that appointment, you're going to put it off and put it off and put it off. And so it's this feeling of stuckness of, oh my gosh, I need to do it, but I can't.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can probably relate to that too. Especially if you've been fighting or fleeing for so long.
It's exhausting.
It is. It's exhausting. And that just isn't sustainable. I know for me in my own journey, there was a lot of times in the beginning, it was more fight or flee. And then I think it definitely got to a point where I just didn't have the energy. And I even think about too, just like sitting in a doctor's office and they're talking to you and telling you things. And you don't even know how to respond when they ask you if you have any questions. There are things you wanted to ask, but maybe in that moment, you just, you can't seem to recall a single question that you wanted to ask.
Yeah.
And you can barely do anything but just smile and nod and wait for the appointment to end. And maybe even when it doesn't, you can't remember anything the doctor said.
Yeah. Because all these responses we're talking about is, you know, when we think about what's happening in our brains, something has triggered us. Something has activated that state in our system where we've interpreted there's a threat. And in that moment of threat, our brain says, oh, we need the parts of our brain that are wired for survival. We don't actually need the rational thinking part of our brain. And so that lovely prefrontal cortex, the thing that helps us make lists and remember to do things and interpret conversations with doctors, it goes offline. Things are coming in and out of short-term memory, but they're not actually being stored in that long-term part of our brain. But instead, we are accessing the parts of our brain that are wired for survival that live in our brainstem, which is much further down the road. And in there, we see those responses that are happening below our awareness. And so at that point, it's no longer a choice in how we're responding. Our system has said, hey, it's more important to protect you right now than to actually think about what's happening.
I think that's really impactful too. I know when I was learning about trauma, that was kind of a light bulb moment for me, just realizing that it's not really something that we can control.
Right.
So I think a lot of people who have experienced trauma possibly ask the question, what is wrong with me? Why did I just lash out at this person? Or why did I have to run out of this room crying? Or why can't I remember the grocery list? Or why can't I remember what the doctor said? And to me, just knowing that our brain and the way that it's functioning is altered
right.
when we experience trauma, and that it's not that there's anything wrong with us in the way that we are responding, that to me is really empowering because yeah. it makes it physiological and not just an emotional thing or a right. I'm not enough to handle it thing.
Mm-hmm. And these responses at one time worked for us. Otherwise, they wouldn't still be stuck around and accessible to us. And so when we think about it that way, we think about, man, our brain is pulling from something that at some point, somewhere, helped us. And so the intention behind it is always good. Our brain and our body are always trying to protect us.
I love that. Our brain is trying to protect us from hurt, from pain, and that's good. But I guess what I'm hearing you say is that it could get to a point where it no longer serves us, especially if this has been going on and we've been in that activated trauma stress response for a long time, that staying in that place could actually be detrimental to us instead of helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other response I'm thinking about that is one that is not as often considered or talked about. We may be more familiar with it when we think about people pleasing. I think that's a really accessible way to think about it, is when you tell someone yes, but you really mean no. And yet the yes is the thing that allows you to avoid conflict or maybe to get something that you need from that person. But in that response, we are going against what's happening inside of us. And so fawn is the response that we're describing. And that is where we are appeasing someone. We are submitting to a process in a way that we are just going along with it. We're doing whatever it takes to keep the peace, to get our needs met, even if that's not true to how we are actually feeling.
That, yeah, because I think I'd really only heard about fight, flight, or freeze until honestly, probably the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. I think, too, it's tricky because a lot of people who possibly are fawning from the surface and even internally, that may not look like a trauma response at all.
Right.
I talked earlier about wanting to say what I thought my doctor would want to hear to make sure that he thought that I was okay.
Right.
So that there wouldn't be any any type of threat to my continued treatment or options offered. Because I think people going through fertility challenges or going through pregnancy loss, like we often do feel like we're a burden to someone. And there's a lot of pressure if we have friends, family members who are pregnant. And so it's almost like we feel this overwhelming pressure to make sure they know that we're really happy for them. Mm-hmm. So maybe even we sign up to throw the baby shower or we make sure that we're the first one to like and comment on their pregnancy announcement photo on social media.
Yeah.
So what are some other ways that people respond in a fawning way, not necessarily related to fertility or pregnancy loss, but just with loved ones?
Yeah, I'm thinking about like when we are going through hard things and we have this belief that, man, if I let somebody know that I'm not okay, if I share this, I'm going to risk either losing this relationship, even changing the dynamic of it. And that feels really scary. And so we might show up in a way that says, yeah, I'm fine. All is good. And we might even focus so much so on the other person that we are showing up for them. We are supporting them in really big ways. And in doing so, we are minimizing our own stuff that's happening because the fear of losing the relationship or changing the dynamic of it is so much greater.
That's so true. Even with work, I feel like sometimes we can kind of go into that mode, especially those of us who work in the helping profession.
Right.
And then I know, too, that for a lot of us, we feel like maybe we've been on this journey for years and that maybe the people in our life are possibly getting tired of hearing about how hard it is or the struggle. And so we kind of feel this burden of, man, every time someone asks me how I am, I'm never good. Things are really hard and they have been for a while. I'm really struggling. And that maybe a lot of us kind of feel like there's some kind of limit on how much we can need as far as support goes or share. And then it needs to be our turn to then be able to support them.
To carry the burden.
To carry the burden. And so it's like almost a fixed mentality that there's like a finite amount of hard or difficult that we can share before we kind of reach our limit. And now we're kind of sensing that we need to start being okay. Or like you said, this could impact the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about triggers. I think triggers are kind of a buzzword. But when we're in the context of trauma and someone who is triggered, what does that mean? What is a trigger?
Yeah, so I really want to start with that, with just the basics of what a trigger is, because we do. We think about it automatically in the context of trauma. And so we associate it with being a negative experience. And so triggering is anything that activates us in our system. And that activation could be really positive. It could be, man, I just walked past this store and smelled this candle that reminded me of my grandma. And that is such a really wonderful, positive, sweet memory. And so in that moment, it's activated a state within us that's associated with memory. And so when we talk about triggering in the form of trauma, we're talking about something that has activated a piece of traumatic memory that's stored in our system. And so it could be any of the sensory pieces that we talk about, something we hear, something we see, smell, taste, touch, any of those things. It could also be that we are in a place, maybe, that feels familiar to something that was traumatic. It's any piece of a traumatic experience that is stored in the nervous system, and it reminds our system and is interpreted in the present as perceived threat. And this can initiate that trauma response that we've talked about in any of its different forms in order to protect us. And sometimes after trauma, our threat detection system that is taking in those triggers and activating the protective response, it was originally programmed to protect us, but after trauma, sometimes we misinterpret cues. And so things that typically would be considered safe, it might be totally benign, not a threat to us at all, but it has reminded us in our system somewhere of something that was related to trauma, and now we're responding to it as if it was dangerous.
That's really helpful. What does that look like when someone is triggered physiologically in their body? But what physically, like, what does that feel like to be triggered? What does that look like?
So when I think about what it feels like, it brings us back to the different trauma responses that we talked about. And so it could feel like, whoa, I'm responding to this thing and I don't understand why I'm responding this way. It feels really big compared to what the actual experience is that's happening. Others may say, oh my gosh, why are you reacting that way? Seems really big to them and out of proportion maybe to the experience. But as far as how we might feel triggered in our body, sometimes it feels like a surge of energy where we feel that heaviness in our chest, the panic, we start to tighten all of those sensations that exist in our body. And it feels pretty instantaneous, pretty reactive. We might also experience it as all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I'm holding my breath. I feel like I can't move from this place. I can see the door, but I can't get there. And so it's this very sudden response in our system that is intending to help us survive whatever the perceived threat is. But it can often feel out of proportion to the current circumstances.
What would be some things that you would say to someone listening that would be helpful for them to know as a friend or a family member about the way that trauma could present and things that are normal?
Yeah. So when I think about trauma responses, I really think that there isn't anything that would be considered not normal. I think all trauma responses are valid. And I think the trauma is the piece, you said this earlier, but that is the thing that is abnormal. Although very common, unfortunately, is the abnormal experience. And so anything that our system does to respond to that is truly wise at its core and has really good intention and would be on the spectrum of normal. I don't really love that word, but I think that it is valid. Mm. So the other thing I think about is I heard this quote somewhere at some point that anything that appears to be hysterical, overreactive, is often historically rooted. And so if we're seeing someone respond to a situation, they're not responding from that present moment. They're responding from a place that their system has taken them that is rooted in the past. And so it's going to feel out of proportion to what's happening in the present. But something is similar enough to a time that was dangerous. And so their system is saying, we're going to go ahead and jump into this and protect you. The final thing I would say to that is that, as we talked about with the brain, it, trauma responses, when especially when they're big and overreactive, can feel really scary, but usually they're not within the person's control. And so they are not choosing to respond in the ways that they are, but their system is doing what they feel like is best to protect them. And that can come across in an overwhelming way, but we have to know where that person is actually responding from.
In that lens, and you already touched on it a little bit, but what are some other ways besides validating someone's experience? If someone listening loves someone who has experienced trauma in any form, what are some ways that they can support that person in their life?
I think the first I would say would be consistency. And so whether this is reaching out in a really non-threatening way of just, hey, thinking about you, but doing so in a way that shows that I'm still here, regardless of how your response is to me, I'm still here. The other I would say is a patience of knowing that this process is going to take time, that healing will happen, but it might take time. And so being willing in that place of patience to educate yourself as well on what this looks like, and maybe that even means seeking your own support.
That's great. I think we don't think about that piece mm-hmm. nearly enough. I love what you said earlier, that everyone is deserving of support. If someone listening thinks that they have experienced traumatic stress, whether that's, again, their reproductive journey or something else, and maybe even thinks that they may have symptoms of PTSD, what are some things you would recommend for them to do? Where do they start?
In all transparency, healing from traumatic stress is a process of attending to our body and a nervous system that has been in distress. And we have to do so in a way that opposes the chaos and tends to it with compassion. And being able to look at our symptoms from a place of recognition that at one time they helped us to survive, even if they're not helpful anymore in the present. And I think it's important that we have to honor the body in the way that it's chosen to respond before we can even ask our body to try to change that. Which honestly sucks to say and really sucks to hear when we're in that place, but it is true. And our body needs safety to heal, to know that they are safe even with us.
I mean, you said it perfectly. It does suck to hear that mm-hmm. when you're in the middle of it. You just want to feel better and you just want mm-hmm. the distress to go away and for things to go, you know, quote, back to normal.
Right.
And navigating that, quote, new normal mm-hmm. can be really, really tough.
Yeah.
So what would you say to someone who is identifying with a lot of what we've talked about? What can they do next?
I think the first thing I would say is tell someone in your life that you trust. That can be an open door to figuring out, what do I need? What do I need right now? And one of the things I, of course, am going to recommend is therapy. And that sounds really easy, but can be a hard process to get started. I would also say finding a therapist that you connect with is the key. And that might take a couple of tries, and that's okay. I also would encourage finding a coach, finding any type of support group that you can be a part of, where there's a sense of understanding, of validation, where you don't have to hide these experiences, where you can be transparent and you can process them.
That's great. And just for everyone listening, I have already invited Molly to come back on the podcast and talk a little bit about therapy and what the therapy process looks like, how to find one, what to do if you've done therapy before and it hasn't been a great experience. So just know that that's coming. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about it in this episode, but in the next few weeks, we'll be releasing another episode where we will go into that in a lot more detail. But I think, Molly, you're spot on. I think finding a therapist is essential. I say this a lot, but my only real regret as far as therapy goes when I was going through my journey is that I didn't start it sooner. Mm. And I tell my clients now too, and I'm pretty passionate about saying it's never too early to start therapy, and it's also never too late.
Yeah.
I think some people kind of get stuck on either of those things, like, oh, well, I'm mostly okay. This mm-hmm. is only affecting my life a little bit, so I don't really need therapy. And you said it earlier, you deserve support no matter your experience at any point. Mm-hmm. So I think it's never too early, but it's also never too late. If someone listening happens to live in South Carolina where you're licensed and is interested in working with you as their therapist, where can they find you?
The easiest place would be to find me on Psychology Today. You can go to psychologytoday.com and you can type in my name, and that'll be listed in the show notes for this podcast.
Well, Molly, thank you again for joining us today. I loved everything you said. I think this conversation is so important to have, especially just through the lens of reproductive trauma. It's just not talked about nearly enough, but I think any conversation about trauma is so worth having. I would love to know if we could summarize our conversation with just a word of hope or encouragement for someone listening who has experienced trauma. What would you say to that person?
Your pain matters, your story matters, and you're deserving of support no matter what stage of healing you're in.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If this is your first time listening and you're new to Catalyst for Courage, I would love to invite you to connect with us over on Instagram at Catalyst for Courage and to sign up for our newsletter at catalystforcourage.com. In both of these spaces, we share even more courage and hope, as well as helpful information, tools, and resources to support you wherever you are on your journey. If you loved this episode, please let us know by leaving a review, and don't forget to click subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Until next time, friend.